Good morning, New Mexico, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company and streaming on the web at ksfr.org. We are podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show whenever you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes, and you can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe. Later on in the program, we're going to be speaking with Catherine Galan of the National Association of Latino Independent Producers, and we're going to be speaking with Phil Grabsky, filmmaker who's made this incredible film called In Search of Beethoven. I'd like now to welcome Sandra Cisneros. She's the author of books of fiction and poetry, including The House on Mango Street, which is celebrating its 25th anniversary of publication this year. And she and Esteban Rael Galvez, the new director of the Hispanic Cultural Center, and until recently New Mexico State historian, will be together tonight, Thursday, August 6th, at 6 o'clock at Collected Works Bookstore on Galisteo Street in Santa Fe. Welcome, Sandra, to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you. If you hear some dishes clanking in the background, it's because I'm in the kitchen of the Mabel Dodge Lujan house, and they're putting the dishes away here.
Well, I hope it's not the ghost of Mabel moving the dishes around.
No, it's a very lovely young lady here, and I'm just trying to stay out of her way.
Okay. So tell us about, and it's interesting. I read The House on Mango Street many years ago, and it's interesting to read the introductions to the new introduction that you wrote 25 years later. Tell us about your discovery of the art of writing about things that you know but really had never before looked at as the subject for written stories. People you grew up with, family and neighborhood, so-called ordinary people.
Well, I think if you grow up poor or if you grow up a person of color in the United States, you're not used to seeing yourself in print, on the page, and so you don't really claim ownership of your own stories. You think you have to sound like the voices in books. And unfortunately, most of those stories aren't by women. They aren't like people from yourself in the same economic class. So it takes a long time before you give yourself permission to speak from your true voice. That would be, I guess, comparable to maybe white kids putting on the rapper voice when they write, you know, the rap songs, because they don't feel like they can tell their own stories. They've got to sound cool. Well, for me, it was the opposite. You know, I felt like I had to sound like this very erudite voice and a male voice, a voice that didn't deal with my own stories. But it was actually when I was at the University of Iowa, which was such a negative experience for me. But, you know, I had a negative experience there that turned out to be positive. And that positive, the negative experience was being in an environment, I think, that might have silenced me. And the positive experience was that because I didn't feel at home there and I felt uncomfortable, I had to explore that discomfort and ask myself where that discomfort came from. And from that discomfort, an awareness that my culture, my stories, my community wasn't present in the books we were looking at and had never been present. And a decision had to be made to either leave and say, I don't belong here, or to say, well, why haven't I seen my story, and I'm going to write that book. And eventually that's what came to be. That's how House on Mango Street was born.
And that was transformative for your writing, for you as a person, and in turn for many readers who also saw themselves and their lives as they had never seen before in print.
Yeah. You know, I was, once I moved away from graduate school, I was a teacher at an alternative high school, and I started incorporating the stories from my young students and populating them in a neighborhood from my memory. So the book that began from a place of memory changed and became a piece of fiction as I peopled it with the stories of my students, my high school kids.
I was thinking also about how really every piece of literature is ethnic literature of some kind. I mean, John Updike is ethnic literature of one certain subset of American culture, and Faulkner as well. It's not like anybody really has, what would you call it, a right to write about their people more than anyone else.
No, that's true. But if you haven't seen stories written with the type of English that you use or the type of perspective that you use, you somehow don't feel as if you can write from that place. You know, you think you have to write stories about Paris or about New York. And for me, being at Iowa was so disconcerting because I felt as if my voice was one that, when I spoke, both physically and spiritually, was foreign, even though I was born in the United States. So it took me a long time to first recognize that silence was coming from a place of shame that I didn't feel until I got to Iowa, and that that shame could transform itself to anger, and that anger could transform itself to a piece of literature that moved away from anger into some place of light and peace and eventually transform itself to something positive.
It's a great story also of the positive uses of anger, I must say.
Well, yeah, you know, I could have quit, and that wouldn't have done me any good. But your first reaction when you are recognize that you feel ashamed is to say, oh, I don't belong here. I'm not good enough. I'm just going to go home. That was my first reaction. And it took me a little while to ask myself questions of, well, you know, why haven't I seen in any piece of art my community represented in a way that I know is honest and true, in a way that's filled with love. And I decided to write that book. But, you know, first you got to get angry. And anger is a good emotion because it's a catalyst for action. And in the process of writing, you move to some place where you compost that anger into something positive.
In Iowa, as you write, they focused really more on how to write than what to write, and they never focused on how writing could serve others, and you really have brought those things to the forefront. I'm wondering if you have another perspective on it now, and I'm thinking of all the really large quantity of very earnest but bad writing that is intended to be of service but doesn't have the power or the tools to do so.
Well, I think anything can be of service if it comes from a very spiritual place, whether it's even cooking a meal or any job that we do, however menial and humble, if it comes from a very humble and loving place. And for me, you know, I had to learn that out of necessity, I had to come up with some writing that would serve my students. And I was writing House on Mongo Street as I was teaching them. I felt disheartened and powerless by the lives they were leading, the stories that they shared with me about their lives. And I didn't know what to do as a teacher with their life stories except to embroider them in my own piece of fiction that I was writing at home in evenings and weekends. And I truly believe out of just, you know, writing it with love and humility, because I didn't feel that I was ready to make money or to become famous or to get an award. It was just coming from my heart. But when you do that work that comes from your heart with humility, it always turns out wonderful. It always gives you a spiritual reward that's greater than money and fame. It just so happened that the story I was telling was relevant to the time in history that we're living, and I was able to sell that story, but that's not why I wrote it.
In the 1980s, you found other Latina writers, Chicana writers, Gloria Anzaldúa, Marjorie Agosin, and New Mexico's own Denise Chavez, and many others. And there was a great liberation in discovering each other's work and coming together. What's that community like now? Both the literary world and the greater world have changed a lot in terms of the visibility of so many people who were once really ignored. What's the community like, and what battles are you still fighting?
Well, you know, I just saw Marjorie Agosin last week in my own writing community, the Macondo Writers Workshop, which is part of my foundation, and she came and donated her services to teach our colleagues. We're a collective of writers that come from underserved communities, and we believe in service to community. And Marjorie was here along with some other Latino writers that have joined us, Denise Chavez, and non-Latino writers, because, you know, the work it goes beyond ethnicity. There's a lot of underserved communities in the United States right now. So I think that, you know, sometimes we have a lot in common. not necessarily because of ethnicity, but because the communities that we represent are under siege. Maybe the community is gay or lesbian, or maybe the community is working class, or maybe the community is from Appalachia. All of these writers come from across the United States, and we all have in common that idea that our writing has saved us from self-destruction, and through the writing we can save other people that we love in our own communities. So there's that commitment and that idea of generosity being an obligation, but not just an obligation, but a privilege. I didn't find that kind of social commitment in Iowa. People were coming with their own interest. There wasn't a sense of community. There was more of a sense of competition. But I like to draw to me writers that I feel are going to help me to do the work of donating their skills to help the collective to write books that are going to have a long shelf life. So that's a little bit different than in Iowa. You were a little suspicious of your classmates. You were competing for financial aid. There was a sense of a hierarchy. I don't feel that with the community that joins me in the Makonda workshop.
You also have engaged in all kinds of activism, not just your writing, even to animal rescue.
Oh, that's just something I do. Nobody really knows about that. I live next to the river. There are lots of stray dogs. I wish I could take in more than just dogs. There's a lot of human beings and other living things that need rescuing. But what I can do is rescue dogs and find homes for them, and that's something I can do. But, you know, we all have different situations that come to us that we feel it's within our power to make positive change. For me, it's not something I planned. It just happened to me.
Your work has been translated into Spanish. How does it read to you in Spanish, and what kinds of responses have you gotten from Spanish-speaking people?
Well, in the beginning, like 15 years ago, my work used to be translated into Cervantes Spanish. And it's only recently that the Spanish that's been used in the border and a Spanish that is based on Mexican Spanish that's been allowed to be used internationally. I think it took the Spaniards a while to recognize that there was another Spanish that was legitimate besides their Spanish. So in the beginning, when my work was translated, it was a little odd. But now I work very closely with the translators that are translating my work into Spanish, and it's much more representative of the Spanish we speak in Mexico and in the U.S. Spanish as well.
That's so interesting. It's wonderful that you get to actually work closely with the translators. Do writers usually get to do that?
Well, I don't know that they'd want to or that they could, because it depends on whether you know the language well enough. And it also depends on whether you have the time. Fortunately, I've known the two translators that have worked on translating my work, the Mexican writer Elena Poniatowska and the Mex-Tex writer Liliana Valenzuela. They're both friends of mine, so I've been able to work with them closely.
And who is reading your work in Spanish? Do you have an audience in Latin America?
You know, I have in Spain, and I'm told I have an audience in Mexico, but I don't know who's reading my work. I have an audience in Italy, of all places, that's very strong. But I don't always meet this audience that I'm talking about. People tell me, but it's kind of like they're talking about relatives who don't write to me.
It's funny. I've just have been thinking a lot lately about the relationships that have been or that could be made between Latinos and Latinas in the United States and in Latin America. It seems like there could be more of that than there is.
Well, we're trying to do that with Makonda, with my Writers Foundation. We do have that community, and we are trying. Many of our members come from other countries, so my dream is that we would have that community of writers. But not all writers are interested in donating their services and looking at other writers' work and in serving, a community, they may not feel compelled to do so. Just because they're Latin American writers doesn't mean that they have a sense of commitment to community.
We're talking to writer Sandra Cisneros, who will be in Santa Fe tonight, Thursday, the 6th of August, at Collected Works Bookstore at 6 in the evening. Tell us about the evening that you have planned with Esteban Rayo Galvez.
Well, I don't know what's going to happen. I haven't talked to Esteban yet, so I have no idea. I'm expecting to talk to him later, and I will see what we will do. Because he's such a close friend, that I want it to be a conversation, and I have no idea what's going to happen, but I do know it's going to be a lot of fun.
You know, I loved the introductions. Susan Berkholz loaned me the book with the 10th anniversary of the house on Mango Street, and then the 25th anniversary just came out with a new piece. And
yes, the introduction. I tell people that the introduction's longer than the book.
I know. Well, it's wonderful to read. And
it's longer than any of the chapters, for sure.
It is. And it paints a picture of a very vulnerable and interesting young woman whom you write about partly in the third person, who has a lot of fears and you know, puts it out that, like, living in sketchy neighborhoods and being on her own and not following the things you're supposed to do, like get married and so on, and writing into brand new territory, as you've been talking about, and also this inner fire that kept her going, that kept you going. Now, a quarter century later, what has changed? Are the same fears still there, or different ones, or is it just easier?
I think that throughout our life, you know, we get over one fear and other ones pop up. I think I'm probably more centered than I've ever been in my life, and then other fears pop up. You know, I'm looking to do other things in my life now that I'm 54, going on 55. It's not about publication so much for me as it is about spiritual growth. I feel the responsibility of being a storyteller for so many people in a time of extreme xenophobia, extreme Mexophobia, and situation is a lot worse for my community than it was 25 years ago. So I feel this responsibility to gather up as many of the young writers as possible and to get them to take their work seriously, to honor their story so that the books last longer than a season. And I think that's why I'm focusing on the workshop that I have, the Macondo workshop, and training writers, I think, who are out there doing the good work of, you know, the Peace Corps work through our literature and through the volunteer work we do in our neighborhoods. So that's who I want to work with, those generous writers that believe that writing can save lives because it saved their lives.
We had the actor John Leguizamo on the air recently, and I was asking him a similar question of what has gotten better for you know, basically Latin American performers, and he said that for actors the world is much, much better because it's not just the parts of gangsters and janitors that you get to play if you're a Latin actor. You just said the community is much worse off. Tell us about that. In what ways are the Latin communities in the U.S. worse off than they were 25 years ago?
Well, I think that if you look at the news media, basically they're telling our story. It's from a point of view of great fear and great racism. I'm going to say racism because that's what it is, this great sense of looking at Mexican people as being the problem with the economy, of being the threat, blamed for all the ills that society is going through, the terrorism coming from the southern border, all of these problems that are being blamed on a weakest segment of the population, which is the immigrant population. And it doesn't matter if you were born here for 13 generations, we still look like the face that is being villainized. And that's why I think we're in a place that is worse off. None of the presidential candidates wanted to talk about this because they knew it was such an explosive subject about immigration or about the borders. Instead of dealing with it in a way that would create less fear, we're building walls in the very year that is the anniversary of the demise of the Berlin Wall. This is a time in which the media is helping to foment that fear. So rather than extending clarity, dialogue, communication, we have a media that is representing the Latino community as one that is dangerous, that is bringing terrorism and violence, the worst light that one could see Latino community. So for me, maybe things are better in movies, but they're worse than they could ever be in real life if you just read the newspapers.
Well, we're out of time right now. I'd like to thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe, and we look forward to seeing you tonight at Collected Works Bookstore at 6 in the evening.
Thank you so much.
Sandra Cisneros, author of many books of fiction and poetry, including The House on Mango Street. We're going to take a break right now. We'll be back in a moment. Stay tuned to KSFR. I'd like now to welcome Catherine Galan. She is executive director of the National Association of Latino Independent Producers, otherwise known as NALIP. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you. So nice to be here.
So there's a lot of Latino independent film producers?
There are all around the country and all around the world, but our organization is 10 years old and has developed this program to bring to Santa Fe that helps support Latino documentary and independent feature makers, as well as that are Latino, that are Native American, and that are growing up here in New Mexico.
And so what are you doing? You are here in Santa Fe, what, this week, this month?
The Latino Producers Academy is a three-week residential program, so we're here from the 3rd until the 21st of August with our 7th Latino Producers Academy.
And what happens at the Academy?
Well, for 11 days, Latino, Native, and New Mexican documentary filmmakers come to live in residence, work with mentors, and advance their specific film projects, their skills, and their careers, and their relationships will help them to complete and then distribute their films. And then, when they leave, we have another 11 days for independent feature producers and directors. They come out, and the producers work through preparing and funding and packaging their projects, while the directors are given SAG casts, professional crews, and mentors so that they can rehearse, shoot, edit, score, and critique scenes from their upcoming features, just like at the Sundance Labs.
It's interesting and I think important that you are putting together Latino and Native filmmakers, because of course those are false boundaries anyway.
Precisely,
a lot of cases.
That's what we came to discover. I mean, while the national organization is of Latino independent producers, that was what we were founded as. There are many indigenous filmmakers, there are many crossover filmmakers, there are many multicultural filmmakers. This program started 7 years ago in Tucson, and we were invited by the governor and the film office to bring it here because of his commitment, along with Lisa and the New Mexico Film Office, to help support the above-the-line creative talent that is naturally here and also to attract other talent to come here.
So the above-the-line creative talent, when we talk about storytelling, that's a gift that people have, but it also needs a lot of mentorship when it comes to actually telling a story that's going to work as a screenplay. It's going to work as a film.
Yeah, film making is a very collaborative process, and it's a very expensive art form, so it can't be done just with a typewriter and, you know, your imagination. We do a screenwriting program, which we held here in May, and we've done that for 7 years as well, and that's a 5-month program that helps just focus on the script so that those are advanced and ready for packaging and development. What we focus on here during the Academy is the producer's role, who we see as the creative leader of either a documentary or feature, the person who helps to originate the idea, find the material, find the way to tell that story, whether it's commissioning a writer or being the writer themselves, choosing a director, finding the talent and the money and the other teammates that will help to get that film up off the ground and into theaters or festivals.
Well, that's part of the whole problem, the big problem. I mean, you can be absolutely brilliant in every way and finish a film and still have trouble with distribution.
Well, that's one of the foreground issues right now. However, in the same way that technology has helped to equalize the playing field for the filmmaker when you're can now shoot on equipment that you can buy, when you can do so much in editing and in sound effects with
a
consumer
laptop.
Equipment, right? Yeah. The things that you own in your home with some skill. Distribution is also going to be heading in that direction. And so both in the documentary program and the narrative program, we focus a lot on the multi-platform opportunities and technologies for content, for distribution, for marketing, and particularly in the case of the documentary makers, on advancing their social change agendas, because the documentary makers here are not just making really cool films, but they are about issues of great concern to our community and to the culture at large, we believe. And so the new technologies can help to distribute and market and expand the message and the issues in ways that they couldn't even touch a couple of years ago, now that we have these platforms that permit you to watch a documentary on your phone or to communicate with a network through Facebook and let them know that the film is going to be video on demand, or many of the other ways that now filmmakers are beginning at least to get out the message. And the next step, of course, is to make money at doing it. But I think that's not far behind.
Yeah, I mean, I think because Netflix has this
on a Roku instant watch or instant view.
Yeah, that kind of greases the path for all sorts of other instant web-based.
Yeah, there are a number of them that have started or are coming through on that model. The key is that it be a platform that permits revenue to come back to the filmmaker.
Right, exactly. What are some of the social change agendas and some of the stories that people are telling?
Well, we have a project that is looking at sort of the Puerto Rican Malcolm X. And
who's that?
His name is Pedro Albizu Campos. And this particular documentary looks at Puerto Rican identity and culture, but also the continued struggle for independence throughout Latin America, not just in Puerto Rico, but also for that particular leader and country. We have a documentary about the third most polluted city on the planet, which is in Dominican Republic, called Aina, City of Poison. There's Ingratas, which is looking at the injustice of the group of women that are maids in Mexico and what their employers and they look at and how that impacts both their immigration but also their life there. There's
Ingratas, that means the ungrateful ladies.
And that's what we are of them. I mean, this is the problem. Ungrateful for all of what they do.
Right.
One of the filmmakers is telling the story of Jessica Gonzalez, who is a Native American and Latina woman living in Colorado, whose husband stole their three daughters. And she eventually had to sue the United States. There's a lawsuit called Jessica Gonzalez versus the USA that's gone all the way to the Supreme Court about what the police did and didn't do in support of her efforts to stop the abduction and have her daughters return to her.
Were there issues of racism because she was Latina and the husband?
That was part of the problem. And, you know, at the end of the day, her children were killed. They were found dead. So there was a lot of mismanagement.
Do we get to see these? Are movies that are in workshop now, or do we get to see them?
These are the movies in workshop that will soon be seen, we hope, on public television, in festivals, at the Cinematheque, and these are the projects that are going to be pitched at the Cinematheque with pieces of them shown, their trailers or stills from the films, at the event that the CCA is hosting for the public next Wednesday.
I want to go see them all now. I mean, when I think about the garbage that I sometimes watch at friends' house or, you know, you go to the movies and see, I mean, this is the real thing.
They're fascinating stories, the groups of films that we have here this year and the projects that they're working on. And next week when the narrative filmmakers come with their 10 projects, they are amazing and entertaining and sophisticated and captivating and have every marker that they can be successful independent films with some help.
So how have you seen, I mean, NALIP has been, the National Association of Latino Independent Producers, for those of you who are just tuning in, has been around for, what did you say?
10 years.
How have you seen the evolution of Latino film in that time?
Well, there's definitely been progress. At the time that we were founded, there were no television shows that had lasted more than 3 or 4 episodes that were focused on or made by Latinos. There was no George Lopez show. There was no American Family. There was no Betty, Ugly Betty. We see progress there. We also see many more Latino characters in television and in films that are not maids and gangbangers, which is really what they were in 1999. It's really amazing. when the census came out, the 2000 census that indicated the great growth of the Latino population in the United States, and we're now 15-16% nationally and much more in certain states like New Mexico, California, and New York, it woke up the media industry that they needed both to cultivate that segment of the population as audience and as consumers, which is a very powerful economic block.
Yeah, they see dollar signs.
Yeah, of course, which is a leader in most industries, but certainly in media. But also they needed to be more inclusive. That said, there's still a very small number of films that are made by Latinos that are invited to the Sundance Film Festival or the New Mexico Film Festival or Santa Fe Film Festival or New York Film Festival. There are very few documentaries that you see on television, but there are more. One of them, Don't Let Me Drown, which premiered at Sundance last January, will be having its regional premiere at the end of our program here, which is also an event open to the public for the CCA, at the CCA next Tuesday.
What film is that
August
about?
8th. It's called Don't Let Me Drown by Cruz Angeles. It's his first feature film. It's set in New York, and it premiered and won prizes in Sundance this past January. And that's a wonderful film and truly an independent film. And the idea of holding the screening in partnership with the CCA is to introduce the New Mexico and Santa Fe community to some great Latino filmmaking, storytelling, actors, directors. The director will be there, and he'll be talking about it. So we hope that your audience will come.
Yeah, so that's Tuesday night, August 18th, at the
Center for Contemporary Arts here
in Santa Fe. It's a week from this coming Tuesday. It's Tuesday the 18th of August. I think it's extremely important because New Mexico is always talking about how it wants to have and has this burgeoning film industry and so on, and to focus in this way is really part of our own heritage extending beyond the New Mexico Hispanic story into the wider world.
Absolutely. And then next week, on Wednesday, the 12th, the invitation is open to your audience to come and hear the pitches and see parts of the films that the documentary filmmakers have been working on, a number of whom are based here in New Mexico. There's a project called Letter from Cloudcraft by two filmmakers from Abiquiú who will be talking about their project about a group of letters that a granddaughter received from her grandfather who was working at White Sands, which is fascinating. So there are a number of projects that are also about New Mexico, as well as you say, the broader Latino culture and community.
It's wonderful to see works in progress, so that's an opportunity for people to do so, whether or not they are themselves filmmakers, but to see these films in progress. Well, we're just about out of time. Catherine Galán is Executive Director of the National Association of Latino Independent Producers. They are on the web at nalip.org, and if you want more information, you can also call the CCA here in Santa Fe at 505-982-1338, and you can also find them at ccasantafe.org. Catherine, thank you so much for being with us.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
We're going to take a break right now. We'll be back in a moment. Stay tuned to KSFR. I'd like now to welcome Phil Grabsky. He is director, writer, and cinematographer of the film In Search of Beethoven, which opens this Friday at the Center for Contemporary Arts in Santa Fe. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you very much.
So this is an incredible film about Ludwig van Beethoven, a biography that shows a lot that people, even who love Beethoven as I do and love his music, really don't know about. How did you come to take on this monumental project?
Well, it was monumental, you're right. To be honest, I 3 years ago I made a film about the life of Mozart. In Search of Mozart, that's right. And I didn't really realize, I was rather naive when I took on that project, just how complicated, how difficult it would be, because I wanted to be comprehensive. I wanted to meet as many of the great musicians of this, of today as possible, and all the great historians, and try to do something that was started at the beginning, ended at the end, and did as much in the middle as I possibly could. And frankly, during the course of it, it never occurred to me that I'd want to do another one, because it was, it's very hard getting access to these great musicians and orchestras. It's not easy. But along the way, I'd be talking to some of the musicians, and I'd say to them, so confirm for me that Mozart was the greatest composer of all time, that I've made the right choice. And they'd say, look, there's no question he is one of the greatest creative individuals ever to walk the planet. and possibly one of the greatest composers. And then they would pause, and I'd think, oh, no, what are they going to say now? And they'd say, but there's Beethoven. And as a filmmaker, I couldn't help myself. I thought, well, okay, now I have to find out who he is. And off we went on another journey. And as you said in your introduction, the music is just extraordinary. I mean, I didn't know a lot of it, and it's just, he is perhaps one of the greatest creative people to have ever walked the planet, which, of course, is an incredible assertion, but one that I'm absolutely convinced is true.
Well, certainly the movie makes one feel that, and I hope that I haven't looked at the special features on the DVD yet, but do you have, I mean, there are moments where you're watching it and you would die to hear the whole sonata performed or the whole symphony performed. Do you have any longer performances on the DVD?
Well, this is the frustration for any filmmaker. I mean, I shot hundreds of hours of material. There's 60 live performances in the film. But, of course, I can only include, as you say, 2 minutes here and 5 minutes there and 7 minutes there. And so on this particular film, on the DVD anyway, we have, I think it's 6 or 7 complete movements. So, for example, with the wonderful orchestra of the 18th century, they did the 9th symphony. They allowed me to film them doing the 9th symphony. So I have a complete third movement on the DVD. In the film, you can't really do that. There's certain pieces that I let run a little bit longer. What I really wanted to do with the film was try to show the breadth, the scope of what he achieved, and to try and put it into place. Most of the concerts that I go and film or I attend as part of my research or just because I love it, they're often full. They often have, you know, very sizable audiences. But I know from having talked to those audiences that many people don't know why he wrote that sonata or why he was writing that particular mass at that time or what the symphonies were all about, why they change from 1 to 2 to 3 to 4. And that's what the film does. It puts it all into place. And in my opinion, you know, if you have warm blood coursing through your veins, you have to be interested in Beethoven. I mean, he's everywhere. You know, he's on people's mobile phones. He's used in all sorts of Hollywood films. And, you know, just to understand the creative process, of course, also why I found fascinating to me was that with Mozart, you have this fantastic image, which is largely untrue, but the image of Tom Hulce from Amadeus gives you a sense of who Mozart, you know, people have that idea of that's who Mozart was, so I could work against that in the film. With Beethoven, of course, you have the sense of him being old, miserable, misanthropic, misogynist, all these kind of things. And so when I started the film, I was concerned that he would be like that. And actually, my research and the letters and talking to people, listening to the music, actually provides a very different idea of his personality. You know, even old people were young once. And in Beethoven's case, he was very human, very optimistic, perhaps more optimistic for a man and mankind than we can be, and full of love. And, of course, there's a great tragedy in Beethoven's life in that, in going deaf, that didn't really impact negatively on his music, but it did impact negatively on his social life, which is, you know, a great shame for him personally.
He comes through as such a passionate, brilliant human being, but very much a human being with, you know, temper and ego and love and all the feelings that we can relate to, and you portray him in a way that feels very real and not romanticized, which I find very refreshing, I have to say.
That's always the problem with films, you know, whether they're feature films, you know, fiction or fact or documentaries. People are always trying to find a straight line. I don't think people are like that. I think that people demonstrate different characteristics to different people at different times. And I think that, I mean, I've made lots of films about great people, if you like. Muhammad Ali, Pele, great commanders like Ulysses S. Grant, and many films about great artists. And they're very rounded. I mean, the thing that's consistent, I mean, there are some consistencies about them. The thing that's most consistent about genius, if you like, is that it often boils down in many ways to certain characteristics, one of which is sheer hard work. I mean, Beethoven wasn't born this great composer. I mean, he worked at it endlessly. Even when he was getting old, he was still asking after the latest compositions. He'd go and talk to violinists and try to explain exactly, you know, how does the violin work, or why do you need a certain type of horsehair for the bow, and all this kind of thing. And that's what a film can do. A film can look at how rounded a character is, the good and the bad, but also look at all the other aspects, the historical context. I mean, it fascinated me that Beethoven arrives in Vienna 1 year after Mozart dies. It's possible, there's no actual proof, it's possible they did meet 4 years earlier, but 5 years earlier, but he arrives 1 year later after Mozart's death, and yet Vienna has completely changed. It's partly completely changed because of the French Revolution and Napoleon. And that whole historical context is fascinating. Also, when you look at people's lives, and it's true of Muhammad Ali, it's true of Pele, it's true of Mozart, luck plays an enormous role. I mean, Beethoven was lucky. The film explains certain moments when he was just extremely lucky. And then there's parenting, the social context, there's all the other composers around that they're listening to, stealing from, learning from. It's a fantastic story.
Right.
Which gives you hundreds and hundreds of hours of extraordinary music.
Which you then have to edit. I thought it was interesting that you really, the film does seem to, and maybe you can tell me about audience feedback you've gotten, but it does seem to really walk the line between a film that would be interesting to the general public, but also to musicians and musicologists.
That's the hardest trick to pull off. That's the high wire act. I remember a moment when I was making the film about Mozart, where he writes a letter to his father, and he says, you know, Dad, when I write my music, I'm writing for two audiences. I'm writing for the audience that the next day are going to whistle the melody, but also the audience that really appreciate the complexities of what I'm doing. And I think as a filmmaker, that's what you have to do with a documentary. And we've had some great reviews where people have said, and these are reviews I like the best, where they say, look, this film is perfect for aficionados who know a lot about Beethoven. It's also perfect for people who think that Beethoven's a dog. You know, that's all that they've heard of the film about Beethoven the dog, or maybe they've heard that Beethoven's a composer, but they don't know anything else.
Right.
And I think the film does do that. I think a film is accessible in both ways. For those people who don't know much about Beethoven, they won't necessarily appreciate that it's Emmanuel Ax, or that it's the orchestra of the 18th century, or Helene Grimaud, or Jonathan Biss, all these great performers. They won't necessarily hear how great their performance of Beethoven is in the film, but they'll understand, oh, I see, Beethoven was born in Bonn, and this is what happened to him as a child. Oh, that's why he went to Vienna, etc., etc. For the aficionado, you know, you're listening to the best composers, the best conductors, rather, the best musicians, the best historians. And of course, for me, my input, this is very, very complicated editing. We have, at one point, the edit is 12, 13 hours long. We're constantly whittling it down to 2 hours. So, of course, we're making choices. But it's exactly what you have to do with your radio program. You have interviewees like me who talk too much, and you have to edit them down. It was very challenging. It was 9 months non-stop editing.
There's so much in it that's fascinating, for people who love Beethoven, because there are things, for example, one of the speakers in your film says that every work that Beethoven composed was different from every other, that each piece inhabits its own sound world. And that's an amazing thing to first of all, the truth of that is something to be contemplated, but it's an amazing way to actually start listening to the music freshly.
You picked out a fantastic line, actually. The more you think about that, the more amazing that is. Again, in my world as a documentary filmmaker, I know filmmakers who make the same film over and over again. So they're inhabiting the same documentary world, if you like. It's just the subject might change, but it's the same style. Someone like Beethoven, he's constantly... In another modern parallel, perhaps, I watched last night, actually, a film about U2, the band U2, and they were saying how they're constantly trying to reinvent themselves. Every album, they want to do something different. And Beethoven's doing something similar, but he's doing it all the time. And whether it's a sonata, if it's just a piano piece for one pianist, or a concerto, or a symphony, or there's some of the other stories as well. Some of the songs are beautiful that he writes the music for. The string quartet, of course. I mean, I was very lucky to have a fantastic string quartet that I could film. And they are, people say that they're, the late string quartets are perhaps some of the greatest music ever written. It's extraordinary.
The fact that you have some of these world-class players, violinists, string quartet, piano, orchestras, obviously music is to be heard more than it is to be seen, but I have to say, watching some of these people, especially the pianists, play the piano was like watching a kind of dance, and you get something out of the visual part of it as well.
Well, there was a style that I obviously worked on and thought a lot about for Mozart. I mean, a lot of times when you see, you need to go to a concert to appreciate music, but often you're quite a long way back. If you sit on the wrong side of the piano, you can't see the hands. And when people are filming it for television, they're limited too, because they have to be at the back. They can't be in the way of the audience. They can't be in the aisles. It's often a bit dull, frankly. What I do is I go and I film either the final rehearsals or I have complete access at a concert. But basically, I try to get very, very close. And then I think the visuals are just reflecting my own enthusiasm, because I just think it's extraordinary. You see these notes on a piano, for example, is silent, and then there's two hands, and the hands start to move, and this extraordinary music just appears. And as you say, it's like a dance. And, these 10 digits are kind of dancing up and down the keyboard. And these are great musicians who rarely make a mistake, at least not that I hear. And it's a joy to film. And, of course, filming in high definition, which we do now, means that, you're really seeing everything. But the same with orchestras. The Ninth Symphony, for example, which I filmed, I deliberately stayed and filmed the whole orchestra and the choir and the soloists as one, because in a way that's how you want to see it. Well, the Missa Solemnis, again, there must be over 100 people on stage, so I filmed it as an entire group. You kind of change the style depending on the music. The string quartets are really happy with how they turned out, because you can go so close to a string quartet and actually see the powder coming off the bow, or the strings bending. Ultimately, of course, it's about being in sympathy with the music, when you start a film like this, you're very lucky because you have the best. You start with the best soundtrack,
right?
And the rest of it is just trying to be responsible to Beethoven's legacy, really.
We're talking to filmmaker Phil Grabsky. The film is called In Search of Beethoven. It opens at the Center for Contemporary Arts this Friday, the 7th of August. Thank you so much for being with us here on the Santa Fe Radio Cafe.
Thank you very much indeed.
And we hope that every theater in which it's shown has a fantastic sound system.
So do I.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. KSFR is streaming live on the web all the time at ksfr.org. You can email me if you like at radiocafe@ksfr.org. We're podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org. You can hear the show there whenever you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes, and you can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe. Thanks to all the operations staff of KSFR for helping with the engineering today. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team. And after that, Good Morning Jazz.